Hi, I'm Advas Salinger, and you're listening to DevEx at the World Bank and IMF Meetings, a special edition of This Week in Global Development. Every year, in spring and fall, finance ministers, civil society organizations, and private sector financiers gather at the World Bank and IMF Meetings to discuss the state of the global economy. With this year marking the 80th anniversary of the World Bank and International Monetary Fund, a key question is whether these institutions are still fit for purpose given today's global challenges. Join us as we explore that question and share key insights from the meetings. What a week. The World Bank and IMF spring meetings are now over, but some questions linger about reforms and ambition. While some told me that the event seemed a bit lackluster or underwhelming, there was certainly a lot crammed into just a few days. There was some progress on debt, with the IMF Executive Committee approving reforms that should speed support to countries in debt distress. And the World Bank made two big announcements. One, that it would aim to bring energy access to 250 million people in Africa by 2030. And two, that it would support quality, affordable health services for 1.5 billion people by 2030. There were continued talks about reforms, though there weren't a lot of new details on offer. Several shareholders did announce support for so-called innovative finance mechanisms, including guarantees and hybrid capital. And a few of them made statements about callable capital that could help open a conversation with credit ratings agencies. As expected, we heard about IDA replenishment and lots about private sector mobilization. One issue that also emerged was coordination between multilateral development banks. On that front, a new platform was launched to share projects, and the heads of MDB's group committed to actionable cooperation in a number of areas, including climate change and country-level collaboration and co-financing. I sat down with a trio of experts with different backgrounds to get their take on the week. I spoke with Rachel Kite, professor of practice and climate policy at the Blavatnik School of Government at the University of Oxford. She's a member of the G20 expert group on MDB reform, and among her previous jobs, served as the World Bank vice president responsible for climate change. She has been part of G20, IMF, World Bank reform conversations, and so I asked her to share her thoughts about the week and what her takeaways are.
I think we have to hold two thoughts in our minds at the same time, right? One is that there is the beginning of reforms, or reforms are underway in the MDBs, together with the IMF, slowly on some issues around debt. So things are moving. They're not moving fast enough. They're not moving deeply enough. In many respects. But at the same time, you know, the world is in a very, very difficult place. One of the finance ministers at the G20 this week said, you know, it's very difficult to see progress on climate and poverty, and, you know, when we don't have peace and stability and security. And so we're in this very conflicted world. The net flows of financing out of emerging markets and developing economies are 2.5 times greater than they were, you know, at the pandemic. So there's more money coming out of the countries, and that's concessional funding, non-concessional funding, private sector funding. It's flowing in the wrong direction at higher levels than ever before. And so the situation that we face is like ever more grave. But yes, we have got reform going. So the question is, how does that reform pick up the pace? How does that reform broaden and deepen? How do the MDBs work better as a system? How do they work closer with the IMF so that countries are getting consistent, good quality, you know, advice all in the same direction? And then I think the big question this week is the reforms that are underway are the reforms which are within the ambit of management. So where the presidents of the MDBs can work together and smooth things out, like on procurement and things like that, it's happening. Where reform is not happening yet is where shareholders are in control. And that, I think, is the big issue.
So you mentioned the fact that a lot of the world's poorest countries are seeing real outflows of capital yeah. rather than inflows. You know, obviously a lot of people believe, and rightly so, IDA's important, but mm-hmm. IDA's probably not going to make up that difference. Do you think without really tackling the debt challenge, you can solve this issue of outflows?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, the first hurdle is the amount of debt service distress and or the debt service crisis and the debt crisis, right? So we've got countries who are in debt crisis. We've got a larger number of countries who are, in servicing their debt, having to shortchange their education systems, their health systems, their investment in their resilience to climate impacts, etc. And so, whether it's a debt crisis or a debt service crisis, and I've sat in meetings where people have been playing semantics, it's a crisis. And we have to deal with that first because countries simply are, you know, can't make the investments that they need to make, you know, first off, right? And then think about growth and prosperity following on from that. I've sat in small conversations where people have sort of said, you know, can we just, you know, cancel SID's debt? I've sat in conversations where people have talked about what it would take to scale up debt for climate swaps or make it easier to do those at scale. There's also been, you know, many conversations around how to speed up the whole debt cancellation and the renegotiation of those frameworks.
And so what are some of those reforms that shareholders should be pushing for or demanding from these institutions?
So in 2023, the sort of violent agreement, right, that the system wasn't fit for purpose. The MDB system needs to be better, needs to be bolder, and it needs to be bigger. And the bigger is the piece that the shareholders have got to own, because that's about more capital. So we've seen some interesting things happening this week. The US has indicated that callable capital could be treated in a certain way so that it makes it more likely that you would actually call on that capital if you needed to. That should help the MDBs have a different kind of conversation with credit rating agencies. That should allow more finance to be able to be leveraged. The big question is, where is the additional capital going to come from for an MDB system that will be fit for purpose for this kind of crisis? And where is the additional concessional finance going to come from? I mean, I would also say this week that I think we're a little sort of at peak private sector leverage hype. These institutions have to leverage private sector financing much more efficiently and effectively than they've ever done in their histories before. But we're past the point of just sort of going around saying there's hundreds of trillions of dollars waiting there to be leveraged. You know, there's a reason it's not flowing. And those technical, detailed reasons about why it's not flowing and then how you make it flow, I think we're sort of deep into the weeds of that, which is good, but it means that there's much less tolerance for just sort of bombastic statements around private sector leverage.
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly heard a lot of talk about private capital mobilization. So I'd be curious to get your thoughts about the proposals on the table thus far, like from the World Bank, and whether that actually moves the needle.
So the bank has announced a platform of guarantees. Guarantees are a very useful instrument because they allow a little bit of capital to go a very long way, and they're very important in being able to leverage in the private sector. So credit enhancement facilities at the national level work, and they work well. Question why the MDBs don't do more of them. Most of the credit enhancement facilities that we've seen have been, you know, the creatures of efforts outside of the MDB system. So important step forward. But, you know, there's no single sort of silver bullet. So we can't solve all of these problems with just guarantees, right? So, you know, I think it's the how it all comes together that's important. Where we have seen a big focus, and this is also being pushed very hard by the Brazilian G20, is on country platforms. So what do we mean when we say country platform? What is the space where all of the MDBs that would be relevant for a given country come together with other development finance institutions, maybe bilateral or minilateral or whatever, and private finance? So country has an agenda, it's a nationally determined contribution or it's a development plan or whatever, And there's a country platform that's sort of offshore the country, which is in service to the country's priorities, where all of this finance can be blended together and effectively allow for much quicker, deeper investment in green infrastructure or whatever. It sounds like obvious, doesn't exist at the moment. We've seen extraordinary fragmentation in development aid over the last 20 years. Private sector finance gets leveraged in deal by deal rather than pooled. And so it's a good idea, but where's the radical collaboration? And by radical collaboration, what we're meaning is, can the MDBs work off one term sheet? Can they just do one set of due diligence that would operate for all of them? And we've seen baby steps in the right direction. I think 4 or 5 MDBs now are going to do procurement in the same way and things like this. But there's a lot further that needs to go.
Do you think the ambition that you've heard from the bank this week is clearly articulated? Do you think there's a clear sort of vision for the institution? What do you make of Ajay Banga's leadership?
So I would preface my comments by saying that these are really, really difficult jobs. They're difficult institutions with complex cultures, and we're asking them to do things that have never been done before. And then I think we should also be nervous of highfalutin rhetoric that can't be backed up by action. The rhetoric matters because it's a bully pulpit and you galvanize countries around a shared vision. And we've seen in the past presidents of World Banks and managing directors of the IMF who've been rhetorically brilliant, right? And either have or have not been able to mobilize the full capacity of the institution behind their agenda. So Ajay Banga has been in the job, you know, 9 to 10 months. And he's focused on the plumbing. That's what he says, right? So, you know, how can I fix the little things inside the institution that are actually big barriers to being able to do more? And he's systematically going about that. And I think that on that score, I think he gets high marks.
I also sat down with Afsana Beshlas, founder and CEO of Rock Creek, a global investment firm, who previously served as the World Bank's treasurer and chief investment officer. I asked her what stood out to her about the spring meetings this year.
And I think it's a very interesting time when it comes to the World Bank and IMF meetings, and really the future of emerging markets and developing countries, both lower and middle-income countries. What has happened, really, which I think is not in the conversations that happened this week and is very important to start thinking about, is that there's a huge outflow of international funds out of emerging markets. How did that come to happen? What has happened is really twofold. One is the real value of the multilateral flows has come down. And I had actually written about this a year and a half ago, where I pointed to the fact that the net flows that are coming out from the World Bank are much less than the numbers that are generally reported. In fact, it's quite difficult to measure the net flows. It's not a very transparent number to get. So number one, the net flows are low. Number two, net flows from other institutions are low. So the poorest countries are really getting hit on both sides. But then all the speeches about let's get billions to trillions by leveraging private sector resources, and I think people are not really dealing with the reality that private sector is not bringing in resources, private sector is taking out resources. And so I think my feeling was that the people who are leading both at the multilateral institutions, but also the people who are the shareholders who are looking over them, need to first realize what the reality of the situation is.
What do they need to be doing differently? How do they actually need to be changing to address the situation and both to boost their own lending then into these markets that are seeing these outflows, but to actually move the needle on private capital mobilization rather than just talking about billions to trillions?
What you need to do is for the World Bank and IMF and other institutions to be much more transparent themselves. They do give the speeches again on transparency, but the first things first is be very transparent about how much they're putting out. Number two is then on the private sector, there is a lot of potential for private sector, but let's just realize one thing that has changed over the last 20, 30 years. The local capital markets of many of these countries have developed. they're issuing international bonds, but also, despite all the negativity that we hear about emerging markets, the positive thing is that there is local savings are not where they should be. A lot of the local savings do come out of the countries, but still, as we speak, the amount of internal resources in many of these countries is increasing. So if we are trying to do development projects, if we are trying to do more on climate, if we're trying to do more on health, we should start working much more closely with the local capital markets in these countries, both, you know, whether you're in Africa or in Asia or in Latin America, those private sector sources that are local are very, very important, I think, to development. And the multilateral institutions are not set up to really take advantage of that.
So what do you think that the World Bank and the multilateral development banking system can do to either better work with those players or to actually, you know, build the capital markets in a way that the private sector will then come in? Do you have sort of specific proposals that you think they should be looking at?
So one is have a list of projects to prioritize them, not just by financial, but also by environmental and other criteria so that you can prioritize. And then funders can look at what makes sense. Local funders, international funders, and then you can decide what are the other things you want. When you just talk about, let's just do guarantees, let's just do, you know, get MIGA and other institutions to do more guarantees, that's not going to work out. Today, for MIGA, if they want to do a guarantee of a 12 million project or 500 million project, it takes the same time. And the costs are very high. So we have to first get realistic, not just make the high-level speeches, actually work out how are these guarantees going to work. A guarantee that's for 12 million, what kind of requirements do you need for that? A guarantee that's for 500 million, what kind of requirements do you need to do for that? There are some very simple things we could do, like have a list, prioritize, see what needs local capital, what needs international capital, and then if you're going to use sophisticated instruments, use them intelligently, and then get going. No more speeches. Let's just get these projects done.
I also asked her about whether the reforms announced thus far will be enough to make the institution fit for purpose.
So you have to be very cognizant that you do have some of the best people in the world really working in these organizations. How you manage them needs proper leadership. And I think, you know, like I said, we could get projects done in 1 to 2 years. You don't need to wait another 6 months. You can just, anyone who's managing the World Bank or the IMF or the regional banks can do that today. Change your processes. That's very internal. That's very, it's not complicated. There are certain things that are very complicated where you need to go to shareholders, but you don't need to go to shareholders to reduce the internal bureaucracy of the organization, which is really a management issue. It's not the staff issue. The staff are really talented.
Did you see any progress on issues this week, on any of sort of these things? Do you see the narrative changing at all? Do you see a move from this rhetoric to implementation?
I don't want to sort of sound negative on this and the rhetoric in terms of the most of the important pronouncements that have been made are saying the right things, but they're not giving you the next three things that could get done in the next month, in the next 3 months, in the next 6 months, in the next 12 months. And so what I think I would urge the shareholders to do is really get serious. Put pressure on the World Bank to start getting things done. Not to look at the negativity, but look at the need and the urgency of getting things done and turn things around and sort of, instead of talking about why it can't get done, just do it, because so much can get done today as we speak.
Hi, I'm Kate Warren, Executive Editor at DevEx. If you are listening to this podcast, you're likely working to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals. But are you subscribed to DevEx Newswire? Global development can be a fast-moving, complex sector. Our team of global reporters work every day to bring you the news you need to make sense of it all. In DevEx Newswire, we keep you up to date on issues ranging from climate change financing to gender equality and global health to transforming the food system, all in a fun-to-read, free newsletter delivered directly to you 5 days a week. Join the hundreds of thousands of global development professionals who receive DevEx Newswire and visit devex.com/newsletters to sign up to this free newsletter today.
For a bit of a different perspective, I caught up with John Denton, the Secretary General of the International Chamber of Commerce, and asked him what brought him to D.C. for the spring meetings.
To be really frank with you, I actually didn't come here to discuss the redesign of the global financial architecture. I think those discussions are endless and generally have no clear endpoint, by the way. So I think I'm much more focused on what you can deliver. I came here because I want to draw attention to a number of critical issues, which I don't think, particularly at the level of central bankers, governors of reserve banks, a number of the monetary authority guys, the Bank of International Settlement, paying enough attention to, which is the real economy consequences of their decisions and of the frameworks they've set up in order to avoid systemic collapse. But the consequences of that when the economies, when they're agglomerated that are struggling, when you actually add them all up together, is still not going to cause a systemic risk, because therefore not enough attention is paid to the conditions that they need to have in place for them to thrive and prosper. And that means I'm talking to the IMF, I'm talking to the World Bank, but I'm also talking to monetary authorities, the Bank of International Settlement, who actually set up a lot of, and the Financial Stability Board set up a lot of the macroprudential regulatory frameworks that are, that may have made sense in 2008, 2009, but now when you're looking at the number of sovereign downgrades, particularly in debt-stressed, already debt-stressed countries, you're seeing the real-life consequences of that as well. And I'm also talking to the New Development Bank, which is run by Dilma Rousseff. So there's a lot of different players here as well. And I got to tell you, I always find it interesting that it's almost a shock to people to realize the consequences of some of the decisions they've made, that businesses are going out of business through no fault of their own, because the credit rating of the country in which they operate has been downgraded, which means that suddenly trade finance is no longer available to them because a number of international banks have retrenched out of that those economies. So that's the kind of framing of what I'm here to talk about.
And I think that's such an important perspective, because so often in these conversations, especially at the IMF, it's at this sort of 10,000-foot level, right? And it's about macroeconomic policy, and it's not about people and businesses on the ground. And so at ICC, you're in a unique position. You're talking, you know, you have membership from around the world, and really people who are the engines of job creation in their economies. And I do think people talk about, oh, we have to create jobs, particularly on the African continent. And so I'm curious, from your perspective, what you think these institutions need to be doing differently in order to actually deliver on some of those things that they talk about and not then enact policies that are counter to that objective.
Well, let's be frank. They kind of operate in a pretty clubby environment. There's a lot of homogeneity in the type of people who are involved in these discussions. And I think part of shifting the mindset is changing the interlocutors. That's why I think it's, maybe I should say, I'm honored to be given access. But frankly, they need access to the ICC for us to bring them the real-time news and the case studies about what is really going on there, because that's the only way we're going to get them to pay attention. Because otherwise they parse things too easily. Oh, that can be dealt with as a development issue. Actually, no. This is a fundamental economic issue. And actually, it's a geopolitical issue. Because at the heart of it all is, if debt is going to be exacerbated and increase, and you get a situation where at least 30 or 40 countries that we study and we work with are debt stressed here, and we did some work with the UN on this last year, something like 10% of their public available finances are being used to pay debt. That's money that's not going into health, that's money that's not going into education, that's money that's not going into infrastructure. And guess what? That money, that 10%, is going back into developed economies. So if you think about one of the great geopolitical challenges we have at the moment, which is global solidarity on action on climate, that's not helped when there's a breakdown in trust. And these are sorts of issues that are exacerbated by some of the macro settings which are so comfortably agreed upon at 1,000 miles above sea level, when you don't actually notice the detritus left on the ground as a consequence of your decision. So it's that's one reason it's really important to bring fresh voices, voices which actually bring the real economy into the processes here, to ensure that when people make decisions, they can't say, oh, I didn't know that. Because it's actually harder to make that decision. But also, what we're trying to do is get some flexibility in the way in which these frameworks are applied as well. And I think people are listening to us. And you'll hear a lot of speeches this week about the need to help encourage development as well. And I identified, when I was talking about macroprudential, about this is one of the inhibitors. But one of the points I've made to in other addresses I've given here is that if you're serious about development, why aren't you talking about maintaining a functioning multilateral trading system, because curated by the WTO? Because if you actually look at the economic data here, a continued erosion of the WTO is hurting most developing and emerging economies. And so that's the work we've been doing, because people forget the WTO is actually a development tool. That the whole purpose of a big swathe of the Marrakesh Declaration is about the development side. And that is the belief that integrated nations in a global trading network, multilateral trading network, will prosper. And frankly, what we're shown, and I've just shown that this is the study we've done with Oxford Economics, that the continued erosion of the WTO does come with a cost, and it hits developing and emerging economies harder. It hits everyone, but it hits them harder. You're talking about a minimum 5% GDP permanent loss. You're talking about in sub-Saharan Africa, 40% downturn in trade flows. You're talking about plus 40% in South Asia. You're talking about in the whole of the Latin American region, a 25% negative hit on trade flows. And in a way, we knew this, but people have been denying that there's a cost to the erosion of the multilateral trading system.
Thanks for listening to DevEx at the World Bank and IMF meetings, a special edition of This Week in Global Development. If you enjoyed today's episode, please share it, or you can leave us a rating or review. We'd also love to hear from you if you have any feedback or want to get in touch. You can find me on social media at @advasal or send an email to podcast@devex.com. DevEx at the World Bank and IMF meetings is hosted by me, Adva Saldinger. Today's episode was edited by Mai Ilagan.